Thank you, Lance. I find myself in a slightly odd position out from behind the lectern, which is odd for me. You'll have to bear with me because I do have notes. That's part of the Reserve Bank thing. We need to have something that people can download and read afterwards. So I'm going to have to use these notes, but hopefully I can be engaging anyway out from behind the lectern. So thank you very much for the opportunity to speak here today. There's actually a lot going on in payments at the moment, and it's being driven by a burgeoning technology which is really driving to make payments for consumers and merchants more convenient and, might I say, seamless. But I'm going to talk today about a particularly significant piece of national infrastructure which will be really important in this context going forward, and that's the new payments platform, or the NPP, as many of us know it. But before I talk specifically about the NPP, I want to do a little bit of a retrospective, and it's sort of a little bit of what Lance talked about. Where have we actually come from in payments? So over the past 20 years, the way we pay in Australia has changed dramatically, and that's what this graph is attempting to show. So in particular, you can see that back in the mid-90s, cash and cheques were the most common use of payments. But since they've now declined and the use of electronic payments has risen very sharply. So we don't have data on cash transactions in the mid-1990s. You can see the three red dots. They correspond to the surveys that the Reserve Bank has done of cash use. We do them those surveys triennially. But if we can see that in about the 2007, cash accounted for around over 300 transactions per capita per person. So around about 70% of day-to-day transactions were done in cash in 2007. And you can bet your boots that in the mid-1990s it was even higher than that. Our most recent survey in 2016, which is the last red dot, the share's fallen to about 35% of total transactions. Now, we have a lot better information on non-cash transactions. So in the mid-1990s, there were around about 110 non-cash transactions per capita per person, per capita. The most used non-cash transaction was the cheque in the mid-1990s. There were around 45 cheque transactions per person per year. And that accounted for around about a third of all cash of all transactions, non-cash transactions at the time. And you'll see also that the now ubiquitous card transactions, they accounted for about a third of payments at that time, non-cash payments, around about 40 per person per year. And that was fairly evenly split between debit and credit cards. Now, if you come to 2017, the landscape looks completely different. There's now around 500 non-cash transactions per person per year. The number of checks that are written is now equivalent to about 4 per person per year. And it's continuing to fall very, very sharply. Cards, on the other hand, now account for around 2/3 of all non-cash payments. And the use of debit cards in particular has grown very strongly. But you'll also see from the chart that debits, direct debits and credits, which go through the direct entry system, have also grown steadily over the past two decades. And I think it's interesting with direct credits because they were initially driven mainly by bulk payments, so payroll and welfare and things like that. But more recently, they've been driven by person-to-person payments directly between bank accounts to pay invoices. And while it's tried and tested and it's very cheap, the direct entry system has a number of issues that have been increasingly obvious as our e-society has grown. First, while the DE files, the direct entry files, are exchanged multiple times in a business day, there's usually a delay of typically a few hours between when you initiate a payment and when the funds are available in the beneficiary's account. And if you make a payment on a weekend or a public holiday, you have to wait even longer until the next business day to get the money. The second thing about the direct entry system is that there's only 18 characters of free text to indicate what the payment is for. And if you're like me, sometimes that's extremely irritating. This can be a really significant limitation, particularly for one-off payments, where the beneficiary might require a material amount of information to ensure that the payment is dealt with appropriately. And the final thing about the direct entry system is that payers had to know and receivers had to be prepared to give out bank state branch numbers and account names and numbers in order to make the payment. So those particular issues with the direct entry system, among a number of other concerns about innovation broadly in the payment system, ultimately led to the Reserve Bank's strategic review of innovation in the payment system. And the conclusions of that were published in 2012. The strategic directives that were set, the strategic objectives that were set out in that review included a number of requirements of the payment system of the future. And these were the ability to make real-time payments, the ability to make and receive low-value payments outside normal banking hours, the ability to send more complete remittance information with payments, and the ability to address payments in a relatively simple way. So that probably sounds quite familiar to you, because these are indeed all the things that the new payments platform will deliver. So where are we with the NPP? So as many of you will know, the NPP was launched to the public in mid-February, and it's the culmination of around 5 years' work from inception to launch. It's involved unprecedented cooperation between financial institutions to build the capability to send and receive individual payment messages between themselves in real time, and with settlement occurring across the Reserve Bank's fast settlement service transaction by transaction as well. But it's also required the banks to upgrade their internal systems to allow posting to customer accounts within a few seconds. And the resources involved in delivering this system as a whole were substantial, and some of you no doubt were involved in that process. Now, Australia's obviously not the first country to build a fast payment service. FIS, in its 2017 report on fast retail payment systems, noted there were some retail payment systems with real-time features as early as the 1970s and 1980s. The report listed 25 countries with live real-time payment systems in 2017, and it listed a further 10 systems under development, which at that time included Australia. FIS also provided a useful taxonomy to compare and contrast the various systems. It's what it called its Faster Payment Innovation Index. The index rates faster payments systems on the basis of features they provide. So at a basic level, in order to be classified as a fast payment service, the system must provide interbank account-to-account payments in less than 1 minute end-to-end and be irrevocable. So that's the basic fast payment service. But then they have a number of other value-added services and openness to innovation, and they give higher ratings for those sorts of things. So the Australian NPP wasn't rated in this report because it wasn't live at the time, but it will offer many of the features that are rated highly in the Faster Payments Innovation Index. For example, the taxonomy lists ISO standard, 24/7 availability as being highly desirable features, and the NPP offers both of these. It lists fast settlement, the ability to include remittance information with payment, and the ability to assign an alias to a bank account as being some of the optional features that would add a lot of value. And the NPP also delivers these features. There's some other capabilities that the NPP doesn't currently provide, like pull payment capability, but the infrastructure will allow other services to be provided in the future. Now, one of the things that is unique about our NPP is the architecture. There's three facets to this. The first is that the infrastructure for exchanging messages is based on a distributed architecture rather than a centralised hub. So participating institutions implement payment gateways that exchange messages with other gateways. There's no centralised infrastructure or architecture that processes and switches payments. One key advantage of this architecture is there is no central point of failure. But it also means that many of the functions that might typically be performed in such a centralised infrastructure, such as fraud monitoring or exceptions processing, they're done by individual participants. So this might be desirable for individual institutions that want to maintain some control over these processes. The second facet of the architecture that's quite innovative is the separation of the clearing and settlement infrastructure from what we call the commercial overlays. So the infrastructure itself has been set up as a utility, and the pricing will be on a cost recovery basis. And this infrastructure can then be utilised by any number of commercial overlays to deliver services that utilise the real-time clearing and settlement capabilities. The first of these is OSCO, and you've probably seen it advertised. Initially, this offers person-to-person payments, but within a year or so, it's going to offer payment with document and request to pay, a couple of other innovative services. And I would expect that there will be other innovative services that will look to leverage the real-time capability of the NPP. The third relatively unusual facet is the real-time transaction-by-transaction settlement of real-time payments. Retail payments will settle 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Australia has had a real-time gross settlement system for high-value payments for weekday settlements over the past 20 years, and this is indeed best practice around the world for high-value payments. But not many countries currently provide real-time settlement of retail payments, and even fewer of them offer it 24/7. Many fast retail payment services, for example, settle payments in batches throughout the day or only during business hours. So the advantage of utilising real-time settlement in our fast payment service is that it extinguishes settlement risk and it removes the need for other controls on settlement risk, such as, for example, caps on exposures. The fact that these controls are not required removes some of the limitations that might otherwise need to be considered by overlay providers as they design their products. So now that we have this world-class infrastructure, what for the future? So I think the first point to note here is that it's still very early days. Given the complexity of the build and the long-term nature of this very important piece of infrastructure, the launch was never intended to be a big bang. While there's been an extensive testing ahead of launch and a very extended period of live proving, moving into production, as many of you would know, always uncovers issues. So a cautious approach to ramping up volumes in the NPP was therefore an appropriate way to manage operational risks. The second thing is that the experience of fast payment systems around the world suggests volumes will increase quite slowly at first. This graph shows just two systems. One is the UK system and the other is the Swedish system. You'll see that it took the UK fast payment services around about 3.5 years to get to 10 transactions per person per annum. And Swish, which is the Swedish system, it took just under 3 years to get to that same level of 10 transactions per person. Now, there's probably a couple of reasons for the initially relatively slow growth in volumes. It takes some time for people to become familiar with the new system. As Lance mentioned, people are typically very set in their payment habits. Furthermore, like all networks, there are positive externalities the more participants there are. That is, as more financial institutions offer fast payments and the reach of the system grows, it provides greater values to both businesses and individuals. So if none of my family and friends can receive a payment through the NPP, I'm really less likely to sign up to use a PayID or something. But the more people I can pay using the system and the more people I can receive money from, the more value I get. And as the system grows, those sorts of things kick in. Third, as I noted earlier, the system has been set up to encourage the development of commercial overlays using the real-time payment capability. Aside from the additional OSCO services in prospect, possible overlays might include services for superannuation, e-invoicing and motor vehicle sales, just a few things off the top of my head. But I'm sure there's many more innovative minds out there which are turning to the potential possibilities here. Now, this brings me to an issue that has caused some concern among potential new players in this space, and that's access to the NPP. So people observe that the system's been built by the financial institutions. It's governed by a board made up of those institutions, which includes the four major banks. And they worry that these institutions will either make participation very difficult or costly, or alternatively, that they'll have the inside running on developing and launching commercial overlay services. I personally think there's a few reasons to be optimistic that access won't be an issue to the NPP. To begin with, as I noted earlier, NPP is a utility. It is aiming to cover its costs, not to make a profit. And given that many of its costs are fixed, it is in the interests of NPP Australia, which is the company, to get as many payments through that system as possible to lower the per transaction cost. So the incentives are there. I think the structure of the board and the constitution also provide some protection in this respect. So the board's comprised of eight financial institutions. There's the four major banks plus four representatives of smaller and medium-sized banks. There's two independent non-executive directors, of which one is a chair, and there's a director representing the Reserve Bank of Australia. Each director has one vote, and the constitution also notes an objective that NPP has to promote the public interest, including through fair access. So I think the foundation is there for fair access. But I think another point that's also worth noting is that the NPP at its core is an infrastructure that facilitates clearing of payment messages between financial institutions and settlement of obligations across accounts at the Reserve Bank. So in this sense, it's similar to other systems, clearing and settlement systems like cheques, direct entry or payment cards. It's not necessary, nor is it even necessarily efficient, for all financial institutions to participate directly in clearing and settlement. NPP, for example, there are three aggregators that provide indirect access to institutions that don't want to incur the cost of participating directly. And indeed, there's already around 50 smaller banks, credit unions and building societies that are able to offer fast payments to their customers using these aggregators. So they're already there. Similarly, it's not necessary for non-financial institutions that want to use the real-time capability of NPP to participate directly in clearing and settlement. So just as these firms use the rails of other payment systems through a financial institution to offer their services to customers, they'll be able to use the NPP. NPP Australia is already engaging with startups on how they might utilise the infrastructure. More generally, if a business doesn't like the price for fast payments it's getting from its bank, there are many other institutions and aggregators that can offer an alternative. So in the end, though, if it looks like lack of access is going to stifle competition, the Reserve Bank does have the power to designate and set an access regime. Now, I'm fairly optimistic, as I said, but there is always that option if things don't work out as planned. Finally, I'd just like to say a few words about fraud. Now, it's been noted that in a world of real-time payments, fraud can also be done in real-time. So unlike the current system, where there's a few hours to review and halt a fraudulent payment, in a fast payment system, the money can be expected to be long gone. Now, I'd like to highlight, really, that this risk is not new. It just happens faster. And this was an issue that was considered really thoroughly in the development of NPP. All the institutions had an interest in considering it. And the industry drew a lot on experience from overseas systems, particularly the United Kingdom in this respect. There's a few ways in which the NPP and the participants are attempting to address the fraud risks here. Banks obviously have their own fraud detection systems and controls associated with interbank transfers. They include things like transaction limits, two-factor authentication, and algorithms which help to identify suspicious transactions. Now, these things will all be in place with the NPP, and they are indeed in place with the NPP. But in addition, when you make an NPP payment using a PayID, the sender will be shown the name of the account to which they are paying. Now, this is an extra step, and that'll assist payers to make sure they're paying who they think they're paying. There is also verification processes in place for registering PayIDs. So the PayID is the system that allows customers to assign a different sort of alias to their bank account. And the system of registering ensures that people who are who they say they are. So pay ID registration can only take place from a customer's internet banking portal or app. And in addition to this, the NPP itself, the system, has a fraud liability system in place, a framework that's consistent with existing consumer protection frameworks, and it allocates liability for fraud where fraud's the result of inadequate verification practices. But, like all payment systems, customers need to be alert to the potential for fraudsters to trick them out of details that would allow fraud to occur, for example, their passwords. So educating consumers on these risks remains an imperative for regulators and for the financial institutions. So in conclusion, NPP is an important piece of payment system infrastructure that will pave the way for further innovation in the payment system. It's taken many years of hard work from the industry, and it's been undertaken in a great spirit of cooperation. But we now have a world-class fast payment service, and I encourage the industry to embrace and create valuable services for the customers. Thank you.
We probably got time for a couple of questions. Any questions from the floor? One over here.
Hi there, I'm Michael Paparo from Stans Australia. Thank you very much for your presentation. My question is around, as the change in the new payment system moves to one which is decentralised and the onus on, protections around fraud, but also I assume cybersecurity would be in the hands of those financial providers of the payment system. You talked a little bit about ISO and how the new payment system incorporated some of those sort of things, but in regards to cybersecurity, has there been much consideration about how those providers of the new payment system will ensure protections around cybersecurity for their customers?
Thanks for the question. You've hit on one of the hot button issues, not only in payment systems, but more broadly. Cybersecurity has been a very important part of it. As I said earlier, there's not a centralised hub, so there's no cybersecurity having to surround a centralised hub. And you might argue that that's quite helpful because there's no honeypot there. I think that the cybersecurity programs of the financial institutions, they have all the incentives to maintain cybersecurity. So it's not just related to NPP, it is broadly. They have great interest in making sure that they are maintaining and continuing to stay ahead in cybersecurity. So I'm very confident that cybersecurity in the system it's as good as the institutions, and I think they do a very good job of it. And the fact that you do have a decentralised and you don't have a central hub means that you don't have concerns around a cybersecurity of a honeypot, if you like. So I think it's all good.
Please join me in thanking her for her speech.